Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Extreme philanthropists make people nervous. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Beyond those very generous people who commit to sharing their surplus wealth, there are those who can't sleep at night unless they give till it hurts. Whether it's a couple adopting 20 children because so many lack stable families, or a woman whose only spending on herself is what it takes to literally keep her alive, we can admire people whose commitment to the right thing plays into every self-sacrificing decision they make, but that doesn't mean we can relate to them. So how do people come to be so devoted to the well-being of those they don't know? And what are the trade-offs of a lifestyle that puts a cause on par with the obligation most people feel to blood relatives? Larissa McFarker is a staff writer with The New Yorker. Her new book is called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. Larissa, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you get interested in people who make these vows to just extraordinary causes and unwavering commitments to these causes?
Well, I wanted to know what this sort of person would be like. Would they be burdened by their principles, or would they be a source of joy to them? I just didn't know. So I started out talking to people who had donated one of their kidneys to a stranger. And in the course of talking to these people, I discovered that they'd encountered an enormous amount of skepticism and hostility in doing what seemed to me to be a straightforwardly selfish and extraordinary act. Family members were resentful. They said, "Why are you giving a kidney away to a stranger? What if one of us gets sick?" Friends just thought it was bizarre that they would do such an extreme thing. And even the doctors, and you would think that doctors are pretty comfortable with the idea of helping other people, they were very skeptical and thought these people are nuts.
And I suppose some of it is that people who do something to sacrifice themselves in a way that is really extraordinary makes the rest of us look pretty weak in comparison, right? If my friend sells her car and walks everywhere in order to send thousands of dollars to our favorite charity, the check I write for $100 seems pretty lame.
Yes, and I think that is part of the reason that there is so much skepticism about these people. We want to believe that there's something wrong with them. We want to believe that we're okay for not doing as much. I mean, they don't think that they're extraordinary. They think they're ordinary. So many of them feel, even the people who give away almost all their money, that to them it's just a duty, like not stealing. So just in the way that, you know, if you go to the store and you walk out without stealing a single thing, you don't give yourself a pat on the back. It just goes without saying. That's how it feels to them. But to us, we look at them and we feel reproved, even if they don't say anything to us. And we have all these ideas about such people. They must be very self-righteous. They must be judgmental. They must be annoying. I wouldn't want to have a drink with them. I think that's a lot of that is defense.
It's funny. I was thinking, reading this book, about how uncomfortable I am personally with people who are self-righteous. And I don't know why, because sometimes they're self-righteous about something they have every right to be self-righteous about.
I so agree with that, because I really think, I mean, that's one of the conclusions I came to in doing this book, is I feel that little character sins like self-righteousness and being judgmental are very overvalued in our culture. We think of them as this huge problem with a person, a deep flaw. If they judge other people, I think it's a small thing. I mean, it's annoying if someone's self-righteous, but, you know, compare, say you have one person who devotes their whole life to helping the homeless and is a little self-righteous about it, and then somebody else who's a delightful cynic who's fun to hang out with but never does anything. Right. Are you really willing to say that the first person is worse? I certainly don't think so. And I think another mistake we make about people who are judgmental is that they think that they're superior. But I think the opposite is true. If you're judgmental, that means you think that other people are capable of doing the same thing. If the kind of person I'm writing about thought, well, you know, I am a saint, let's be real, and no one could be expected to do what I do, that would be bad. That would be acting superior. But they don't think that. They think there's nothing special about me and there's nothing special about what I'm doing. They don't understand why everyone doesn't do something similar. And they judge them for not doing it precisely because they think they can.
Your title, Strangers Drowning, refers to a made-up dilemma, a sort of logic problem that sounds obvious at first, but quickly grows more complicated.
Yes. Well, there's two. I kept encountering drowning strangers in philosophy problems, and at first it got kind of funny, and then I decided to name the book after them because these problems really do capture what I'm getting at. One of them is if you are at the beach and over here your mother or your child is drowning and over there a certain number of strangers are drowning and you can save one or the other, which should you save? And if it's one stranger versus your mother, of course you're going to save your mother. But what if it's 10 or 20 or 1,000? You know, many of us might just save our mother anyway. But the kind of person I'm writing about at a certain point would start to feel guilty. The other problem that involves a drowning stranger is one posed by Peter Singer, the philosopher who's now at Princeton. He said, suppose you're walking along, you see a child drowning in a shallow pond, shallow meaning you're not in danger if you try to rescue him, but it will sully your clothes. Maybe it will ruin your clothes. Ought you to rescue that child? And anyone will say, well, of course, you'd be a monster not to. And he says, okay, aha, but we know that there are children drowning and starving and dying of various horrible ways all the time. And you could help to save some of their lives by donating the amount of money that it would cost to buy a set of new clothes. But you don't. How can you justify that? Part of what's behind this example is he wants to press the idea that distance, physical distance, is morally irrelevant, that it shouldn't matter if the child is right in front of us or far away and invisible. And logically, you can see his point. Why should it matter? But actually, I think that physical distance is very, very deep to people, that we do have a responsibility to help people right in front of us in a way that most of us don't feel for invisible strangers far away.
And I suppose part of the problem for many of us is that we realize that even if we make this commitment, we can't possibly make a dent in things. So we might do a little bit, but we don't feel the need to sort of change our whole lives. These people who are devoted to really extreme idealism, they don't let that stop them.
Well, also, they wouldn't agree. I mean, it's true that you can't save the whole world, for sure. But you can do quite a bit, and that's the annoying thing for the rest of us. I mean, it's comforting to think, well, poverty is insoluble, and famine and sickness, they're too big for one person to contemplate. But you can do little bits. You know, many of these do-gooders that I write about know that it's not going to be helpful to try and make people feel guilty. So they've developed other sales pitches, as it were. And one person I spoke to, a philosopher at Oxford, who gives away, I'm not sure what percentage, but a very large percentage of his income, he says, imagine Oscar Schindler. He saved, I think it was about 1,200 people. Well, you could be Oscar Schindler. You could be two Oscar Schindlers. How great is that? Just for giving away the money that you don't really need, the extra bells and whistles on your life, you could save all those lives. Now, mind you, it's more complicated than that. It's not so simple as the pitches from charities often make it seem, that you donate X amount of dollars and boom, there's a life saved. Of course, it's very complicated, and aid often goes wrong and sometimes even harms the people it's trying to help, which is another reason why many of us throw up our hands and think there's nothing I can do. But that said, it's certain that money given to an effective charity that's doing good can make a difference.
Larissa, do most of the folks that you interviewed for this project have a clear origin story for their devotion?
You know, it's interesting you should ask that, because I went into this project kind of on sides. I wanted to defend the extreme do-gooder against the skepticism and hostility that I perceived was often felt against them. And I started reading a lot of psychological theories about altruism, and many of them I just thought, bah, you know, these are just attempts to discredit these people. They're trying to pathologize them, and so we can feel better, and we're so healthy that we don't actually give anything. But there was one theory that did strike me. There was a theory called the parentified child. The idea is that a child growing up in a household where there's at least one parent who's really not functioning as a parent, either maybe they're alcoholic or they're severely mentally ill, for some reason or another, they're just not being a parent. And the child may feel that they're responsible for everything that's troubled about their family, and they try to fix it. They try to become the perfect child. They maybe try to do as well as possible in school, and they also try to take care of the family members who are not being cared for by the parent. They take care of the youngest siblings. They clean up the house. They try to make everything right. They try to fix things. And the idea is that this sort of child will grow up to feel an outsized responsibility as an adult to try to fix the world in the way that they tried to fix their family as a child. And at first, I had the same reaction as I had to other theories. I thought, ah, more pathology. But then I was looking at the people in my book, and I thought, it is quite striking that not every single one of them, but a lot of them grew up in families like that with either an alcoholic or a severely mentally ill parent. And so I think there might be something to that theory. Now, mind you, that said, I still don't think that that discredits their sense of duty, because while it may be true that a child growing up in a troubled family may feel compelled to do good in the world as a result, imagine another child who grows up in a great family with two parents who teach that child to help others out of a sense of moral righteousness, and that child grows up feeling equally compelled to do good in the world because of his parents. And I don't really see why one sense of duty should be considered more free or true than the other just because one comes from a set of bad parents and one from good.
My guest is Larissa McFarker. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker and author of a new book called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. We'll resume our conversation with her in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes for more of our conversation with Larissa McFarker.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New Yorker staff writer Larissa McFarker. Her new book is called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. You can be part of this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Larissa, for The New Yorker, you profiled a couple who also occupy a chapter in this book, Sue and Hector. They came to a point where they adopted more children after having two of their own than most people could dream of raising. Tell us a little bit about them and how they got started with this.
Yeah, they met in high school and got together and decided to get married. And their initial plan was to have two biological children and adopt two. Sue had read a book when she was a kid called The Family Nobody Wanted, about a family who adopted this multiracial group of kids, even though they were not wealthy people. And it sounded wonderful to her. She really wanted that. So the initial impulse was that it sounded fun, not that, you know, she had a dry altruistic urge to help. And Hector felt the same way. And moreover, Hector came from a family of 16 biological kids. So to him, the family they ended up with was not so weird. It just was a normal family to him. Anyway, they started adopting, and they had two and adopted two. And by their early 20s, they thought they were done. But then they learned more about all the children out there who needed homes, who didn't have parents, and who were very unlikely ever to get parents. And they thought, we can do this. We can do more of this, because they loved it. They were great parents. And, you know, for them, it was their calling. It, just in the way that someone who is a great artist or a great athlete or an entrepreneur who is just passionate about what they do, they're willing to give up ordinary things like kicking back on a Sunday or going to the movies. They're willing to put up with a lot of difficulty in their life to do what they're great at. And that's how it was with Hector and Sue. They just wanted to be parents to a lot of kids and help them and give them a family.
eventually, of course, there were costs not only to their finances but to their relationship, because it's one thing to be great parents to four children. It's different when you've got 14 or 22. It's just hard to give any of the children the time and attention they need. And, of course, somebody has to be working very hard to have enough cash coming into the house to put food on the table.
Yes. And, yes, it was not an easy life by any means. And, you know, they were unconventional in the way they had their family. They were also unconventional in the way that they managed it. Sue was the one who went out and worked, and Hector was the one who stayed home and changed the diapers and made the school lunches. And Sue became a pretty well-known adoption advocate, and that meant she was often traveling. And she even took a job in Washington, two separate jobs, which meant that for 2 years she was in Washington for 5 days a week, and Hector was at home in Philadelphia taking care of the kids. And, you know, there weren't 22, I don't think, in the home at any one time, but there were a lot. And that was very difficult. That was very difficult. And it was pretty amazing that they held together both the family and the relationship, but they managed it. They had a lot of hard times. You know, Hector at one point started drinking to just deal with the stress of the situation, and Sue would get migraines for the same reason. But they made it through, and even though a lot of difficult things happened to them along the way, so every single one of their girls got pregnant before getting married, even though, as you can imagine, teaching their kids the most important thing is not to have kids until you are in a stable situation where you can care for them properly and be proper parents was something that Sue and Hector told their children over and over again. So even so, the girls all got pregnant, and so that was pretty crushing to them. And then some even worse things happened. One of their sons ended up in jail for beating up his girlfriend, another one for having a sexual interaction with one of his younger sisters, and that almost destroyed them. But it didn't. And, you know, something I'd really want to emphasize about this family is it's hard to imagine because they are 22 kids. That sounds almost institutional to those of us who don't come from 16, as Hector did. But it's not an orphanage. It's a family. And the way Sue and Hector think about it is, you know, it may be true that things would have been easier if we'd had fewer kids, and certainly we would have had more time and money and attention for the ones we had. But then what about the kids that we didn't adopt? Hmm. Life would have been so much worse for those kids. And this is something that I came to realize was a fundamental difference between the kind of person I'm writing about in this book, Extreme Altruists, and the rest of us. For the rest of us, we feel that we want to give as much as we possibly can to our family, and that's our first duty and our first desire. And usually that family is pretty small. And Sue and Hector love the children as much as any parents, but that's not all that they do. They don't think that that's the only thing they're here on earth to do is take care of a few kids. They think about the kids who are still out there, who are still strangers to them, and whether or not they can bring them in and make their lives better.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Diane on the line in Highland Village. Hi, Diane.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I actually read that story in The New Yorker, and I really enjoyed it. But one thing I noticed that really tied this family together, or Sue and Hector together, were that they really practiced their view of Christianity being not to judge people. And I guess I'm wondering then, y'all were talking about self-righteousness among the people that you profiled, but then Hector and Sue seemed not to fit into that self-righteousness category. And I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Thanks for your call.
I completely agree. They are not self-righteous. And in fact, none of the people in my book are. Partly because they think what they're doing is normal. They don't get all puffed up about it because it just seems normal and something that more people should be doing. They're not idiots. They understand that to other people it seems extreme, but it doesn't feel that way to them. So they don't think they're so extraordinary. One comparison that Sue made was she compared herself to someone who tries to climb Mount Everest. Because she's experienced many people who encounter them with bafflement. Like, why did you do this thing? Why did you give up an easier, more normal life for this very extraordinary life that most of us would find too difficult? And she said, it's like the person who tries to climb Mount Everest. To outsiders, that seems like kind of a crazy thing to want to do. Why would you give up your ease, your comfort, and maybe miss many important family occasions for this goal that seems bizarre to me? But that's their passion. That's what they most want to do, and that's how Sue and Hector feel. So they don't judge. You're absolutely right. What we were saying earlier is that I feel that, you know, one of the things that people get uncomfortable about when they think about people who do a lot of good, they expect them to be self-righteous. Hmm. And my feeling is that even if they are, which often they're not, but even if they are, you know, that's not such a big deal compared to how much good they're doing.
It is sort of amazing to think about, you know, if you just consider your own life and the people you know who either volunteer for everything, maybe they're not extreme to the degree that would have put them in your book, but people who are really generous, how many of them don't give it a second thought and aren't necessarily, just based on their temperament, aren't necessarily looking to point the finger at the rest of us. They're just kind of leading by example.
Absolutely. I mean, they're not thinking about the rest of us. They're thinking about the people they're helping most of the time. So that's quite enough to be going on with for them. And actually, it's another striking thing about the people I'm writing about. So most of us, if we saw someone in need right in front of us, we would probably help. If someone collapsed on the subway or someone, you know, we saw someone desperately hungry right next to us, we might feel empathy, compassion, wanting to help them. That's ordinary. We've all experienced situations like that. But the difference with these people is that they have, you know, I came to think of it as an almost aesthetic ability, an imagination, a vividness of imagination that allowed them to almost see the people who they can't see right in front of them, but they know they're out there, to feel their suffering and to be as moved to do something about it as we would if someone was right in front of us. It's almost a kind of moral genius to be able to see something that is not there, that the rest of us understand intellectually is a problem, but it's not vivid to us. It doesn't move us to action.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it because, you know, we know about the problem of, you know, you can hear about something like a tsunami and you know that hundreds of thousands of people are affected and homeless and really, truly miserable, at least in the acute moments of the disaster. And yet, you know, journalists have talked about this problem that profiling, you know, one child in this situation or one family is likely to motivate more people to care, which is a strange thing. We all know intellectually how great the scale of the problem is. We just can't get our heads around it. And therefore, we're not necessarily motivated to do anything.
Exactly. I think it's true. I mean, not only will we be more moved by one person, but I think I read something recently that charities have found that we'll give more if we think that one person is in need than if we think 10,000 people are in need, which doesn't make any sense, but that's just how most of us are wired. But, you know, I think in a crisis like a tsunami or like the current refugee crisis in Europe, it brings out the best in ordinary people and, you know, like myself. I don't want to set myself aside there. And we're all moved to help because, as I said, it's vivid to us. You know, that one photograph that everyone in the world saw of that poor little toddler in Europe drowned in a puddle made the refugee crisis vivid to everybody. But these people don't need that photograph. And, you know, there's a certain kind of – there are a lot of different kinds of people in this book, but there's one kind that goes about their giving in a very rational and abstracted way. They think, well, you know, I could do the sort of traditional do-gooder thing and become a doctor or an aid worker and go to the third world and help out directly with my own hands. Or I could do something more removed, which is use my first world education, go make some money, and donate that money to bankroll 4 or 5 or 6 doctors who could do more good than I could by myself. And people find that off-putting. They think that's too cold, that's too rational, that's too almost self-absorbed because you're not seeing the people that you're helping. But when I talk to people like this, I found that they are, again, as moved by the thought of suffering as most of us are by the sight of it. I was talking to one young man who was a philosophy graduate student, and we were talking about Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and he'd read in that book about the suffering of people, I think it was in the Middle Ages, nameless people who he would obviously never know or meet or know very little about, but he started to cry because the thought of their suffering, even hundreds of years ago, was so vivid to him that it moved him to tears. And that's really a different kind of person. And so when he gives money to a charity, it's not cold. It's rational, but it's not cold.
My guest is New Yorker staff writer Larissa McFarker, author of the new book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. We'll come back to our conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Larissa McFarker.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Larissa McFarker. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker and author of the new book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Larissa, I'm surprised no one has asked about how often the folks that you interviewed for this project are motivated by religion. One thing that you discovered was that for some people, belief in God at least takes a little of the burden off, right? Because on the one hand, for many people, their faith challenges them to do good for other humans. There's also the sense like that God has your back, right? That if the world is falling apart, God might step in and take action. Whereas for people who don't have faith, the sense is that if humans don't fix it, no one will.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the sense I got from a Methodist pastor I spoke to in Baltimore. She had donated one of her kidneys to a stranger. I actually watched her kidney being extracted in a particularly intimate moment of reporting. And she said that that was her sense, that, you know, she felt that ultimately fixing the world was God's business. And that didn't relieve her of any responsibility. She still had to work as hard as she could for whatever seemed to her to be doing good in her community. But ultimately, it was up to God. And it wasn't as though she thought that God would prevent anything bad from happening. I mean, she's not stupid. She sees that bad things happen all the time. But it's not up to her to understand God's plan. She just needs to accept it and keep working. Whereas to her, it seemed that lacking that faith must be a much bleaker situation, because to a person who does not believe in God, you believe that you're alone here, we humans, and if we don't fix things, no one else is gonna. And so it's up to us. There's an additional layer of despair and urgency, perhaps, to the person who does not have faith that God will ultimately do what's right in the world.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jay on the line in Plano. Hi, Jay.
Good afternoon. And thank you for your contribution to the literature on this. Interesting viewpoint. I have worked with Habitat for Humanity for a few years, so that involves philanthropy and getting your hands dirty. A viewpoint that might be useful, or at least interesting, involves something I heard from a talk by Habitat for Humanity International CEO Jonathan Rickford. He refers to a state of holy discontent, and it works like this. You or I may see something on the 6 o'clock news that looks terrible. We look at it, we see, oh, that's horrible, something needs to be done about this, and the moment passes. The holy discontent comes in when somebody sees that news item and says, this is horrible, what can I do about it? There is a difference in viewpoint to that that might interest you.
Thanks for your call, Jay. What do you think, Larissa?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the difference between doing nothing and doing something. And, you know, a lot of the people I'm writing about moved from one to the other. I mean, one young man would pass by posters of starving children and news footage of horrible events, as you describe, and think, geez, I really ought to do something about that. And then one day he thought, well, why don't I? I'm just going to do something about it. And he did. And I think that, you know, one of the things that stops people is what we usually think of. We're selfish, we're lazy, indifference is very easy. It's so easy to stay in our accustomed routine and just get on with making dinner after we've seen something horrifying taking place in some other part of the world. But I think also there are nobler things that get in the way too. A lot of the people I've spoken to, either the people in my book or regular people that I've just met, feel so overwhelmed and helpless at the thought of the magnitude of things that need to be done, the awfulness of suffering in the world, that they don't know where to start. They don't know what to do. And so you have to find a kind of middle ground between not caring at all and caring too much. Otherwise, you're going to be completely ineffective. You have to, I mean, it's a strange thing, but you have to acquire just enough immorality in order to live a moral life. You have to do as much work as you're capable of, and then you have to say, now I'm going to close my eyes and close my wallet and close my door, or I'll go crazy and I won't be able to stick with it for the long haul. And that's really hard if you're the kind of person who sees and feels the suffering of others. But if you don't do that, you burn out, and that's it.
Are extreme do-gooders happier than the rest of us because they do so much to help others? Or are they less happy because they remain keenly aware of the amount of need in the world?
That's a great question. I think both are true. I mean, I think the reason that people are happy, do-gooders or otherwise, have so much to do with just, you know, how you're born and how you're brought up, that it's not as closely correlated to how you're living your life as you might think. On the one hand, the kind of person I'm writing about feels that they are doing what they ought to do with their life, that they are doing what's right. And gosh, that's an amazing feeling. How many of us can say that?
Right.
So that's good. On the other hand, as I've said before, they don't feel that it's particularly incredible. So they don't go around feeling like saints. They just think, okay, I'm doing my duty, which for them is not stealing, not pushing people over. You know, I'm just doing what I ought to be doing. So on the one hand, they do feel a sense of purpose and a sense that they are living as they ought to, which most of us don't feel a lot of the time. On the other hand, yeah, it's burdensome, exactly as you might imagine, to be so aware of everything that you cannot do. And once you start, it's harder to stop. I mean, if you are one of these people who watches something horrific on TV and then just has no problem turning it off and going to make dinner, life is easier. If you have decided to do something, figuring out where to stop is much harder.
I was thinking about the American culture of, you know, sort of taking care of oneself and one's own. On the one hand, this is a good thing, and most people feel really compelled to provide for those who, you know, the spouses and children, that sort of thing, parents. On the other hand, there's this sense that, you know, we have to do for our own because nobody else will. And that can make it easier to turn away from need that may be just, you know, next door, but not within our own home.
I agree. And I came to feel that, you know, the feeling of taking care of one's family can be a kind of moral alibi that, you know, it feels very good because you're giving and giving and giving to others, but not really. I mean, you're kind of taking care of yourself. These are your people. These are your family. It's not really giving to strangers. And I think one of the reasons that we find it easy to care only for our families is that we tell ourselves, well, these do-gooders who care so much about strangers, they probably don't care that much about their family. And there is this cliche, especially in fiction. You know, Mrs. Jellyby in Dickens's Bleak House is the prime example, but there are lots of characters like that who it's a zero-sum game for them. If they are always thinking about starving children in Africa or whatever, they don't care about their own. But that's not true. The people who I'm writing about care just as much about their family as anyone else, but that's just not all they do. So we talked earlier about Sue and Hector Badeau, who adopted 20 kids, many of them with profound emotional and physical and or physical problems. Every time, as the family got larger and their kids got older, they would have a family meeting when they were thinking about adopting a new kid. And in the early stages, the kids were usually in favor. But as the family grew and grew, sometimes the kids would object and they would say, no, you've adopted enough. We are not getting your attention as it is. You've got to stop. We don't want any more kids in this family. And that cut them to the quick because they loved those kids just as any parent would. But they also thought about those other kids who desperately needed parents. And it's that decision was just as hard for them as it would be for anyone else. It's just that they felt a responsibility for kids who weren't theirs. And that's not coldness. That's a moral genius, I think.
Larissa McFarker is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. Larissa, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me on.